Greetings, listeners, and welcome to the Experience Grind podcast. This doesn't feel right. And the reason it doesn't feel right is because the entirety of last month, you guys openly said that you were doing scales and stuff as you're trying to figure it out. And you're like, oh, it's totally lifted from the Cape podcast. So guess what, fellas? Hello, friends! Welcome to the Experience Grind podcast, the podcast about getting older and the experience we gain from movies, games, and pop culture. I'm this week's host, Dave, and I'm joined by Brian.
Jeepers, I'm an eager beaver to get this show on the road, so don't be a fuddy-duddy and knock it off with the gobbledygook.
Kyle!
Quick impression. Am I Dave post-pneumonia or General Grievous?
General Kenobi.
Wow.
You are Kyle doing his best Sean Connery into a cup. Ryan!
I fancy myself a smart fella, but I can't say I dimity to kill me.
And
or
Sean.
To save me?
I feel like I would have really thrived in the silent film era.
Why?
Because nobody would have to listen to me.
That's
and
not
I'm
how
just
that,
a pretty
that,
face.
That's, nope.
Me too, but not pretty face.
Nope, that's not how that worked.
I'm the face.
That for radio. That's why you're doing a podcast. Guys, I am so happy this week that we are kind of getting into my lane a little bit here. I wanted to go into the Wayback Machine, and I wanted to talk about something a bit older. One of my great loves is talking about film history and seeing where things come from and seeing where they've gone and where they are today. I feel like it's a medium that you can do that with, and it's because it's still such a fairly new medium that you can track it back. It's not like music where you're just looking into a cave going like, Gronk banged together two rocks, and now it's four times signature or something like that. Here, we actually have a history that we can go back to. And this week, we are talking about one of those movies from history that is considered a seminal film of the film noir period that wasn't yet named, 1944's Double Indemnity, directed by Billy fucking Wilder. I'm assuming this is your first time seeing it, everybody.
No, I've seen this 100%.
This is my first time seeing
what?
This.
Who's Sean saw it once before?
No, I have not.
Kyle saw it before. Sorry, you guys sound similar to me, which is probably the pneumonia talk.
No, yeah, I've seen as I've said before, Dave. You and I we're the film noir boys. Like, I know this is a genre that you love. This is a genre I love. The one thing I think we disagree on is I like Falcon a whole lot more than you ended up liking it once you finally watched it, but.
It's kind of like a precursor to this movie in a lot of ways, where it set a lot of the ground rules. And then this is the movie that kind of put it all together to become what it would be going forward, even though film noir didn't even have a name for another 20 years. They didn't know that they were making something here. They just were making a movie.
Mm-hmm. This is one of those that, like, everything that parodies film noir is taking a lot from this movie. It set a lot of that standard. So,
absolutely.
Sure, and we will absolutely get there. How about we just dive right into this thing?
I think that sounds great.
That's the best way to do it.
And I think the best way to do it is by going full Cape podcast. We're just going to rip it off even further by doing it the whole way through here.
It's an homage?
Exactly. That's what we're doing. I'm doing an homage to myself, which may be the most egotistical thing I've ever done.
What are you, Kevin Smith?
It's like Dawson and the B in Apartment 23.
Yeah.
I've never seen that show. I know it exists.
Specifically.
That's something,
what's
right?
his face? Dawson Creek. He plays an exaggerated version James of Vander himself. Beek. James Vanderbeek. Thank you, Ryan.
Dawson Creek sounds like a spy thriller on like the CW that no one will watch.
I'm surprised they haven't rebooted it as that.
Yeah. Agent Dawson Creek.
Brian, how do we usually start off these episodes?
We usually start off with our scoring system, which of course is out of 100 points, 10 categories, 10 points each.
100 points, boys. There are no decimals, no halvesies, no any of that shit. All right? Every category is 0 to 10.
If it's real
zero
good,
to 10.
We sometimes
0
to
10.
11.
See, Brian's
if something's
already,
really good, you can turn it
I'm already breaking the rules. Listen, I know.
No, you're allowed to.
I know what this movie is, and I know who Dave is, and I have a feeling that we were going to see a couple 11s be mentioned, tossed out here. So
it's funny, because the way that I worded this talking about it is when you guys were talking about all the songs that like were your essence, your DNA that are inside you. I listened. I got to watch you guys. I saw some tears being shed. And I went a totally different direction that entire episode because I just wasn't ready to be that vulnerable about some things. Going back to a movie in the Wayback Machine like this, something that I hold so near and dear to my heart, especially a flick like this, this is my vulnerability showing. Because I never know how it's going to get received by my friends or listeners or anything like that, especially because it's an older movie and a lot of people have issues with them sometimes, as they probably should sometimes.
Wait a minute, and Kevin Feige sure didn't produce there. This?
No, not this one. Even though he would have had a pretty sick hat if he did.
I'm sure he would have. This is one of the, like, I consider anything 50s or pre. I just in my head now, I'm like, oh, this is a Dave movie. I associate you with classic Hollywood.
Not a I'm bad with that. Association.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very I mean, fine with that.
That is who you are to me. Like, because you've always appreciated it. That's one of the things. I've always been intrigued by it. Like, you dive headfirst into it. I'm a casual observer that enjoys it. But
I have a feeling we are, you and me, Dave, are going to have a lot of stuff to talk about, like, in the near future. Because I knew that Sarah liked older stuff and, like, really has an appreciation. But she was sitting there while watching this. She's seen this movie before. And she's just sitting there casually name dropping all of the actual actors and actresses in the movie.
That's awesome.
And like, oh yeah, you know, she, Barbara Stanwyck, yeah, she was such a big name in this time. And so I have a feeling I'm gonna be seeing
Can
a lot of
these
movies.
Here instead? Can we sub?
I can
tag
go
her in?
Her. I had this idea actually to swap places with her halfway through the episode.
But had that she would have seen been very this movie confusing before? To
listen. Tag team
yeah,
match.
She's seen it.
Sean, had she seen it before? She had? Okay.
Yeah, she's seen, like, all of these. I think I'd actually be pretty hard-pressed to find a movie from this time period that's relatively well-known that she hasn't seen.
That's why I like her a whole lot more than you. Yeah, are you ready to dive in?
Already
talk about this bad boy?
Yeah, why don't we dive into it? Our first category is casting.
So the cast that we have here, we have Fred McMurray, we have Barbara Stanwyck, we have Edward G. Robinson, and then we have others for the most part.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I want to hear kind of some opinions before dropping.
I mean, all right, so we're going out of 10. I don't want to give the score yet, but I'll dive in and say that Edward G. Robinson as Barton Keyes is a real highlight of this whole fucking flick.
He's so good.
100%.
Yeah. So Barton Keyes is a great character. The way that Edward G. Robinson plays him with just that ever present curiosity is great. He's one of the great detectives of old, and he does a lot of the heavy lifting of the noir stuff because we're seeing the crime aspect. So the actual detective is ancillary third party character in this, which is a nice development of it too, because usually, you know, it's the crime from this aspect and trying to figure it out, but this time we get the crime from the start. But we see Edward G. Robinson like piecing it together, and it's just perfect. So
it's more of a
I like
a
how you're
done it
gonna try to be on a first name basis with him briefly, and then you realize like no, he's not Edward, he's Edward G. Robinson.
Edward,
of course, you gotta get that G.
Hit that
to
G.
Add on to what you were just saying is like I go into most movies completely blind. If I haven't seen them, I don't watch trailers. I don't even really read the synopsis before I watch something. So I went into this with kind of an expectation that it was going to be like a Private Eye kind of movie. And your Walter Neff character was going to be the person that's kind of solving this thing going on. And boy, howdy, could I have not been any more wrong about kind of the premise of this movie and who was what. So to piggyback off of what Kyle was saying, Edward G. Robinson's Barton Keyes was just fantastic. Even if he's just kind of in the background, it's like you see Fred McMurray and Barbara Stanwyck doing their thing, and in the background you just see like Edward G. Robinson doing a, you know, a cork board with like strings just off in the distance, but he's working his thing.
I like how he's not even trying to solve a murder. He's doing insurance.
He's doing insurance.
That's what he's doing.
It's even better.
That was another great social commentary that I appreciated now from the 40s is that the police don't give a shit. It's the insurance men that are chasing down the real money, as always, those scummy bastards.
I love that our two leads here, Fred McMurray and Barbara Stanwyck, are playing very against their normal typecast, which is excellent.
Fred McMurray I'm not familiar with either of these two actors outside of this movie. I know Fred McMurray was in The Apartment, which I love, but he was a secondary character. He was a little antagonist. Is that what he usually is?
He was
is?
The antagonist. Yeah. No.
Is that right?
So,
okay.
So Fred McMurray, before this, was kind of doing like the happy-go-lucky comedies.
Mm.
And then Billy Wilder came to him with this script, and Fred McMurray said, like, I can't do that. Like, this is totally against what I have to do. Billy Wilder's like, oh, what's stopping you from doing? He goes, it involves acting. Like, I don't do that.
I'm not an actor. I'm a funny guy.
Okay. So he's completely against. This is his first, like, big role. What he would consider, like, a big role. Not, like.
He was already a star at this point, but he was kind of at the shit or get off the pot part of his career of, like.
Okay.
Cary Grant's kind of taking all the roles that you want to do, and he's doing it so much better. So you have to kind of either pivot here or. Nah, pretty much.
Yeah.
And he chose to do the pivot and.
And did
it worked
that,
out pretty well.
Yeah. And did that transition for the rest of his career?
Well, what happened?
I knew nothing about him prior.
No.
And like, I looked him up prior to this recording and I saw quotes of like one of the most underrated actors of that generation. And so.
Because he didn't consider himself an actor. He was a saxophone player who got discovered.
Exactly.
Wow.
You know, as you do.
At this point, he'd been in a bunch of movies as that happy-go-lucky good guy, and he believed that Paramount would not steer him wrong in the roles that he accepted or they would offer to him. So he was like, all right, I'll take the role. It's outside of my normal wheelhouse, but Paramount's not going to screw me on this. And it turns out that Paramount was trying to screw him because he had played hardball in their recent contract negotiations, but it ended up backfiring against Paramount because this film was excellent, and people were like, oh, this McMurray guy can act.
Oh, have you heard about this McMurray
Have you heard about McMurray?
The papers, they all talk about McMurray.
Shut up, baby. Good. I'm turning the movie back on.
Who was the studio?
Paramount.
Just curious. It was Paramount?
Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah, they can eat a butt. It's Harvey Weinstein again.
Well, back then with the whole studio system, contracts, that's all it was. Contracts and loan outs and everything and people trying to screw everybody. It was a fun time, folks. It was a really fun time.
Yeah,
that's why I love the history
with,
of it
Judy Garland around that time, very similar situations.
I mean, they
sort
they
of Judy Garland was a different situation because she came up doing her movies with Andy Rooney, I guess it was, and they just repeatedly abused her physically, emotionally.
Yep.
She's only five at this point. She's 5 years removed from Wizard of Oz, and she's still not that like mentally right. They're still trying to find a home for her even after Wizard of Oz.
All three of these leads questioned whether or not they should take the roles. Barbara Stanwyck was like, I don't know if I'm ready to play like a cold, ruthless killer. And Billy Wilder was like,
turned
out
to be career making.
Are you a mouse or an actress? And she said, well, I think I'm an actress. Like, well, then take the part.
I think that's usually when it works best is when the casting agent or whoever that is the one to make the call and not the actor.
Yeah.
When an actor is reluctant, like those are like the success stories you hear, like Chris Evans in Captain America. He's like, that's not for me. I'm not that person. They're just like, yes, you are. And he was. I think that shows on all of these people. Sorry, go ahead.
Don't say sorry. I'm loving every second
of this. I am sorry because I am a Canadian.
Sorry,
and I will
Dad.
Not say any
damn
other
Canuck
word. You can't say that.
No, it's
or,
fine.
I don't know. Awful. Find out next week.
When you have this era of casting, a lot of times it wasn't a casting director. It was people just plugging in based on your contract of what studio you were a part of at that point.
And that's it.
Which is why Paramount would try to screw him over. Billy Wilder.
Like a buffet table. Yeah. Just like you're with the studio.
Pretty much.
And we want you for this one now. And that's
pretty
it.
Pretty much. And the worst part about it is that if you said no, then they can bench you and you're still under contract even with them. So they could just not loan you out. You couldn't do other movies at that point. So the studio system's a really
essentially blackballing you.
It's a tough time for a lot of actors who were trying to make it. and were struggling to make it.
Hmm.
But Barbara Stanwyck, she became like the ultimate femme fatale after this. She kind of set the mold for the next, I mean, we're 80 years on at this point. And
wow,
Barbara Stanwyck laid the foundation for it.
Again, really... coming from a point of view of really not knowing these actors. And so prior to going into this, looking into them and kind of seeing what they had done prior, you know, you click on Barbara Stanwyck's IMDb and like her last credit before this was Sugar Puss O'Shea or something like that. And it's just,
that's one of those names that's begging for the, ah, Sugar Puss O'Shea.
Yeah. And I don't know.
Get so out of here, Sugar Puss.
It's weird watching something from this era and really having not a really great, you know, starting point. You know, you have Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind, all of the ones that everybody's seen. But, you know, it's fun jumping into this.
If we're talking to the great acting of a lot of these characters, I also found Richard Gaines as the boss of the insurance agency, Norton. And I know his name, thank you to this fancy little sheet from Brian putting this together for us. But it's funny to see such different drastic acting styles because he's obviously like a stage actor. Yeah. Like, he's not bad, but he is just like projecting and taking dominance because he is built for the stage. And it's, you see a couple more people that play that way in here just because it's that era, essentially.
Porter Hall's the same exact way, where he comes on, he's like, I'm a Medford man. You know I'm an honest chap. Yes. I'm a Medford man.
That's exactly like a local play actor that just hamming it up. But it's good. It's fun. It's just different. So
When was the shift from from the silent movie to talkie? Because if it's not too far removed from that, like, that could also be part of it, too. Like, there's some kind of, 20s? Like... getting the
it was 20, 27 with
27
with,
okay
27 yeah.
And then you kind of have a gradual transition throughout the late 20s into the 30s, and I mean they're still doing silent pictures even here, like Chaplin still hadn't fully embraced, so it's not a crazy thing,
like Bobcat Goldthwait in real life.
That's true, because The Great Dictator came out and probably not too far
42
from
I think
Dictators.
Yeah,
it was post-war. Post start of everything and end of it. Yeah, it was Great Dictator's fascinating look on everything. Fascinating.
Yeah, for sure. But that's
casting!
Interesting. So that counts casting. For a lot of that acting.
Hit me with some numbers.
Who wants to start?
Who wants to start? Just because I didn't mention her, but she's going to give it a bump. Oh, sorry, Ryan? Go ahead, Ryan.
Now I'm actually kind of curious where Kyle's going with this, because it sounded like he's thinking
Gene
with
Heather
his bottom
was,
head.
Was a real fox, man. Is. I'm going to go a 9. I'm giving it a bump for Gene Heather.
Gene, wow.
Oh, her acting style is like the worst in the movie.
Oh, it was.
Yeah.
Oh, me. Oh, my. I need a man.
But I'd throw the ring on it. Let's go, girl. That's a 9, baby.
I like a 9.
I feel crazy unqualified to even give a number here, considering like I don't know how good or bad this casting is, like going off the actors. I feel like everybody in terms of, you know, lining up with the characters that they're portraying and the characteristics of them, I feel it was awesome, spot on. I really enjoyed all of that, but also like I don't know if there's better people out there.
Not aware of many of the alternatives, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, I can give it, based off of that, an 8, I guess. Like, I don't have any complaints with the casting.
Ryan, what are you thinking?
Thinking a lot. I don't agree with Kyle at all about the John Heather stuff. Whatever, that's fine. Great, 9 out of 10. I'm more with Sean in that I feel like I just don't, I'm not qualified either. I don't know enough about this genre and like the casting and like who's better. But I do have a tiny complaint. But I also feel like you kind of like argued against it already. But like, I loved a lot of this cast. I had a hard time falling in love with Fred McMurray's character. I kind of wanted him to be a little bit more charismatic, if that's a thing. And I didn't find him, like, super charismatic. Like, I've seen Cary Grant in a similar role, and, like, Cary Grant's fucking charismatic.
It's what Cary Grant made his career on, yeah.
That's why he was taking all the roles.
And so, with this kind of being, like, this steamy love affair that makes him fall from grace, I just didn't get that sexy, steamy vibe from him. I thought he was a little stiff when it came to that. I think Cary Grant, because my knowledge is so limited, could have done this role and could have done it more to what I would have wanted. I won't say better. But, like, I had some troubles with Fred McMurray. Everybody else I loved, and I absolutely, as Kyle said, Edward G. Robinson kills it. I loved his
casting.
He's so good.
So good.
And Edward G. Robinson almost didn't take this role because he was just coming out of being a leading man at this point. And he had to kind of, like, shove his ego down a little bit and say, like, this is a juicy role. It's supporting, yeah, but I'm kind of at that point in my career. I should take this.
Get a little bit older. Maybe I should take it.
I felt a lot like what you were talking about with Fred McMurray's character, the Walter Neff character, and that, like, I just thought he was a douchebag the entire time. I was like, man, he is very unredeeming. Yeah. Like, non-redeeming?
Yeah, unredeeming. Especially with the modern lens, it's hard.
It's like an older version of the Nino Sacchetti character, where he's like, he is just kind of that scummy, but he's also refined his edges and knows what not to do in public. Because he's
not
like,
to yell at people who are just dropping off somebody for a ride.
Yeah, because the dude's a douche.
I don't think you're supposed to like Walter Neff, though. And she's not supposed to really fall in love with him, and that's why he can be stiff, because she's using him to kill her husband. She doesn't care about him.
Actually, very important. Yeah. So you're not supposed to like
him.
Yeah, no,
you're not wrong, but I don't ever, like, and this might be getting to other stuff besides the cast, but, like, his falling into her is so quick and just...
Literally?
Like, hey, you didn't have access to porn every day, and you barely got your... You barely got your horn cranked. You're going to jump at every opportunity.
You're right.
You
when your porn is stored in your upper spank bank, you've kind of got to go with what you got.
Barbara is manipulating him. Absolutely. But at no point do I see him as an actor, like, falling for it, really buying into that, like, seduction or affair or anything. I don't get any of that chemistry from him specifically. And that's it.
I'm going to say we'll get there.
But and I think that blends out we'll of the there, casting. So it's kind of.
Yeah.
But honestly, that big complaint, I'm kind of right where Sean is. I think it's an 8 out of 10 for literally everybody else. I have some small complaints with Fred McMurray, but, like, goddamn, Edward G. Robinson.
I was an 8 as well. I just bumped it up to a 9 because of John Heather.
That makes it a 9. That's our number.
I will not do that.
What's your score, Dave?
10.
10. Of course it is.
It's a 9 with a bump because I like it, damn it.
Because you like it, damn it. All right, I think that's going to give that category an average of a 9.
Nice.
That one's for you, Gene.
Our second category is story and motivation, and this is where the fun starts.
This is where the fun starts. This movie opens up with a man who's wounded from a gunshot, driving his car through the streets of L.A. He's an insurance salesman named Walter Neff. He stumbles into his Los Angeles office and begins recording a confession for a claims manager named Barton Keyes using the crazy technology that is a dictaphone.
Dictaphone.
I love how there's actually more of the wax tubes as the movie progresses, because he's just been talking in the for hours.
It's so
that's
good.
Like, it's kind of
that's,
like...
That's great set building that I wouldn't have expected in the 1944s, but they do it, and it makes sense. It's never drawn attention to. It's perfect.
But it reminds me of, like, whenever you have a bar scene, and then, like, time passes, and there's more bottles stacked up along the bar, so you know time has passed. Here, it's just like, no, there's more dictaphone cylinders.
And he has a beard now, so you know it's later.
He's doing, like, the OG podcast.
Yeah.
He's making a recording for one person.
When I made my Tarantino joke earlier about starting in the middle and jumping around, I didn't even make the fucking reference to this part, which
that's
is
what
really
I thought
just
you were
a Billy
reference
Wilder
to.
Reference. So that's another funny thing I just thought of.
Yeah, we're all laughing hard.
Yeah, I am. I don't care about you guys.
My stomach's doing that flutter thing. Where I want to laugh, but I'm not gonna.
Oh, I thought you had diarrhea.
What?
Similar feelings.
Sorry.
So what he's recording is flashback. A year earlier, Neff is going to meet Phyllis Dietrichson during a house call regarding her husband's automobile insurance. You know, as insurance people do, just showing up.
Door to door.
Insurance is out and you need more. Phyllis is going to almost answer the door, just wearing a towel and a really, really bad blonde wig. And she's going to flirt with him right away and super duper subtly inquires about obtaining life insurance policy for her husband without his knowledge. Which nothing shady about it.
Always on the up and up. Love that.
But
yeah, I love this establishing shot of her. I love it.
He's just, you know, she doesn't want him to worry, so she just wants to do it without his knowledge. It makes sense.
Yeah.
Perfect sense.
As soon as I saw her in the towel, I was like, what year did this movie come out? This is like 40s porn.
It's risky.
It is, and I love the line that he gives, how he's just like, I don't think you're fully covered. Ah, insurance humor.
Oh!
They still laugh about it today.
Oh. This whole exchange between her starting up at the top of the stairs and you've got Walter dropping every sleazy line that he could think of.
Oh,
every
it's 40s. One after another.
It's nonstop. Oh, I wanted to see you without those pesky stairs between us.
It's so cheesy. I laughed
it's the
so hard.
Stairs. Yeah,
I loved it. Yeah.
Like, okay,
what is
dude.
This category, setting and theme?
Nope.
Story and motivation.
Story and motivation.
So we're going over the story.
But for the time, a lot of what this was doing, how he, like, Phyllis Dietrichson is wearing that anklet that he points out right away. That he can't
oh,
take
man,
his
he
eyes
is
off
into
of.
That anklet,
he
dog.
He is. But Barbara Stanwyck wow. was known to have the best legs in Hollywood.
Gams. They were called gams
they really
back
put
then.
The focus there.
Huh.
Good,
they're
good
called
gams,
baby.
Good stems.
Mm-hmm. Them legs went all the way up.
Does
hair.
That person exist now?
I don't.
Does somebody now have the best legs in Hollywood?
I don't know if that's like a thing that they could put
Cher,
in there.
I think they used to say Cher had the best legs.
Did Cher have such great legs that she just ended the tradition?
So that's
people
it.
Saying that people have great legs.
We don't have to.
No,
we
don't
have to look
don't know
anymore.
Who it
we
is
found
now.
It.
Yeah. Just think on it. Think on it, and we'll continue.
I mean, I'm
realizing
Google
that Sean, you Google it.
Cool.
Realizing that Phyllis is contemplating Moira. Neff initially rejects her, but he becomes intrigued, mostly because he's just thinking with his penis.
Mm-hmm.
As you do.
They're going to meet again at it his happens. Apartment, where Neff devises a plan to trick Mr. Dietrichson into signing a life insurance policy, murdering him, and then staging it as an accident to activate the policy's hot tub time machine clause.
Mm-hmm. What a clause.
The name of the movie. I get it.
As everybody knows, when you're making a plan... It always succeeds the more complex you make it. It
right.
worked for Ocean's 11.
Well, kind of.
Whoa.
Kind of. They had to have multiple contingencies. But there is a question of, like, why did we have to go so complicated and specific?
Well, because
are we talking Ocean's
works.
11 and Double Indemnity? I have an answer for both.
Oh, yeah.
Either. Yeah. I think both are valid questions.
I meant Double Indemnity.
I don't think they go terribly complex. They trick a guy into signing something, which doesn't seem that hard in 1944.
No.
It is, and god damn it, now it's like 2 weeks out from when we watched it, so my brain is like all dumb mush. But there is a specific thing where he's like, yeah, and there's this one specific clause that we can do that they never account for an accident on a train when it happens like this. So let's do it like this. And I was like, just immediately like, why don't you do anything else that could just be like a more normal accident?
Well,
why
you gotta make enough money to get
away and payout. They went for that extra money real quick for no reason.
Well,
I got the
perfect
plan.
It's almost like Tobias Fünke, like it never works for anybody, but it might work for us.
Really, his main goal is trying to cover the tracks because he knows that Keys is going to be on the case and knows every trick in the book and can sniff out any insurance scam that's ever been done.
Because he's
been on the job for 23 years or something like that.
The hardest one to thread the needle on.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, because who would actually do that?
That's my question.
This is
the
pro. Actually, this is set in 1938.
Person.
It is set in 1938, and there's a very big reason behind that.
And I don't know if you noticed, but the cost of that auto insurance renewal was $127. So,
boy,
50K
inflation
ain't getting you much.
How much was that, like, adjusted for now?
It's probably about $1 million.
$2,300.
At least that $1 billion. Insurance on a car was $2,300.
I imagine for the full 6 months policy.
Walter Neff is a pretty good salesman.
Well, I guess so.
He must
be fleecing those rich Hollywood types. He got oil money.
Well, it's probably the combined cost of the auto insurance and the life insurance that he doesn't know he's getting.
He's not going to question it. He's got the hot wife. He's got what he needs. He's good.
Oh, shit.
Neff successfully tricks Mr. Diedrichsen into signing the policy by presenting it as an automobile insurance renewal while super-duper subtly exchanging glances with Phyllis. The train on this Moida plot has left the station.
Signing them duplicates, them triplicates.
Gets so upset, but then understanding, like, of course I got to sign it in triplicate. Fucking bureaucracy, right?
God damn it. Insurance agencies always taking my... All right, I'll sign it.
I guess it would make sense to sign the one that you need a copy of.
Who's your CEO? Too soon?
Never.
We're not going there.
I feel like if there were ever a chance...
It would be this one. I cannot believe that there's an insurance thing happening in the world that's so big, and then we're talking about probably the only movie about insurance that matters.
Next week, fires in California.
Oh, boy.
Wait, is there such thing as a double indemnity clause? Is that a thing?
I'm sure.
Volcano insurance?
Just like the double indemnity clause
thing? Like that clause?
I think it's a real thing.
I looked into these actors, but I didn't even look this up.
No, I
yes,
don't
it's a real thing.
Up.
It's a real thing.
I don't know anything.
Yes,
pays out double face value in the event of an accidental death.
Sarah, you want to go on a train ride?
Dang!
Really hope she didn't hear me.
That was awesome. You ever seen Throw Mama from the Train?
Nope, but we're about to get to Throw Dietrich from the Train because, Woo! Well, sort of. Dietrichson's going to break his leg. It's going to throw a whole wrench into this murder plot. Phyllis and Neff adjust their plan to exploit the train trip that Dietrichson is going to take. And knowing that it has to be an accidental death that pays out double. Is it worth it, guys? Is it worth this now elaborate thing where you're bringing in the public instead of just being able to do it in a car?
So I feel like Walter Neff has a habit of biting off more than he can chew, but like having it 90% of the way there every single time.
He's very confident in his own abilities, for sure.
Actually, I think he might have gotten away
with
this.
He's a white male.
If Dietrichsen didn't break his leg. Honestly, I think he might have gotten away with it.
They would have. That's the whole...
Probably.
Crutch,
if it weren't for those meddling kids,
the story.
File a claim on his broken leg.
I am really glad that became an integral part of the story a little bit later on, because the moment that it was revealed that he broke his leg, I'm like, well, that's not good for this story. So I'm glad that did come back around. And
seems kind of random, but yeah, there's a reason.
It
would have
made the intro of a man crutching his way towards the camera. Very he did, weird. Had they not actually done anything like that.
He wanted to call it off in the smallest grocery store ever made.
I think it was a real grocery store.
It's still small.
Not even a set. Just a tiny little baby food aisle of a grocery store.
With security guards. That's real. Because they had to have security guards. It's the reason why this movie set in 1938 is because they didn't want to have to talk about anything involving the war.
Mm-hmm.
And since this was war times and there was war rationing going on, they're like, fuck it. Throw in the past.
There were like four cops on set to make sure that Fred McMurray and Barbara Stanwyck didn't steal any food.
This is wild. Wow.
And like the crew, obviously. Probably more so the crew.
Probably more the crew.
That's fascinating.
What's more fascinating is the way that they do it. Because Neff's going to hide in Phyllis's car. She drives Dietrichsen to the train station. And Neff is just going to break the man's neck. Off screen.
Pretty hard. It's pretty hardcore.
What do you guys think of the choice to do it off screen?
I liked it. I mean, it's especially setting for the 1940s era. Like, you're,
yeah,
they're not going to show a lot of violence in that form, which is weird that they do show the bloody bullet hole, but I don't think they're actually going to show the killing of a man, especially in such a way as the neck crank.
Did that bullet hole not even get bloody until like the last half of the movie or the last third of the movie? Because I feel like I didn't even notice that he was bleeding or where he was shot from until towards the end of the movie, when all of a sudden there was a dark patch on his left chest.
That's kind of the beauty of it, though, because he's talking into this dictaphone and you could tell he's not doing great, but he's still, no scars visibly until recently, as he says. But I like how about halfway through this movie, you start to notice like, oh shit, no, that man is wounded. Mm-hmm. This isn't going to work.
This but man is doomed as he's delivering his narration.
Yeah.
As the genre needs him to be. Yes.
Exactly.
You're not even going to make it to the elevator. But in terms of the neck thing, I didn't even think twice about it because I just thought it was a product of its time of not showing the neck breaking. I just figured, oh, that's a 40s thing. I'm not even going to make mental note of this.
I'll be honest, I thought he choked him until they deliberately call out later that he broke his neck. And I was oh, okay.
Yeah. And I think another reason why they did that, they couldn't show it.
Right.
They can't, you can't show that during the time. But at the same time, Billy Wilder just said, whatever you imagine is probably a lot more gruesome than what I could possibly show.
Like the Jaws.
The old Jaws. Damn it.
I kind of agree and I kind of don't. And it depends on the thing, right? I think with like monsters and certain things, there are lines that you can cross where you show it too much. But and I agree with what Sean said. This is 100% a product of the time. You just can't show that kind of gruesomeness on screen in the same way. But I do think if this film was made now, you would have him show that, because like I think it is inherent to the character and like it is a visual, like, I think it's good to hold the audience to it. I don't strangling a person to death. There's not too many different ways you can imagine that going down. Like, you're getting held down and it's going down. And honestly, if you held a camera, you didn't cut, and you saw somebody strangling like in No Country for Old Men, when Anton Chigurh holds the guy down and he is just squirming on the ground for like a minute straight, that is super uncomfortable. And it really paints a clear picture. That is worse than anything you could hide in imagination, in my opinion. So I think you can show it. I disagree with that.
But at the same time, the layer is
I like
it the on
choice.
The wipe space.
I just disagree with like you can't. It's always it's, better in the imagination. Yeah. Sometimes.
I agree with you there. It's just I love the way that they frame Barbara Stanwyck's face here. Yeah. And it's fully character building at that point. I'm just like, oh God, she is unflinched.
Wow, they are just, both.
They
so
do it
cool.
in an artistic way.
Yeah,
this also has a lot of those classic, like what they do make homage to in the Addams Family movies, where like they have the light line just on the eyes. That classic.
Yeah. I love that. I love
it too, man. It's always so cool.
Neff is gonna
now they have
up
a dead Dietrich.
Yep,
all at once.
They got a dead Dietrichson now. He's in the car.
Yeah.
You got Fred McMurray, Walter Neff. He's going to go onto this train pretending to be Dietrichson, crutches. He's got the cast on his foot, and he's just going to instantly go to the back of the train, to the caboose, because he wants to have a smoke. The problem about doing that is that there's a Medford man out there.
Yeah, Medford man.
Medford.
I'm a Medford man, you say?
You know what that means.
I just
think about things,
have...
I say them, and I think about how much I mean them.
It's true, though. That's I wouldn't. Would you trust a Medford man?
No, that dude is telling me what I want to hear.
Comes off like a carny.
Yeah,
like some sort of carnival barker.
Jesus. Feels very,
but like it's like an Eeyore personality at the same time. Like, I'm a Medford man. Thanks for noticing me. Yes,
I'm just the guy in the back of a train who wants to talk to everybody who comes back here.
There's a witness, no, and that's a problem because Walter Neff is going to send the Medford man to go get his cigarettes because he crutched his way back here, right? He's not going to crutch his ass all the way back. And then with the train going super duper slow, Walter Neff's going to throw himself off the back of it. It works out pretty nicely that the car's already parked there with the dead body in it, flashing the lights, everything. Plan's going according to plan, which is fantastic for them. They're going to take the body, lay it on the tracks. I like how he throws the crutches to make it look like it was random. Yeah. Whatever works, right? Whatever works.
I love the dedicate the time and the film reel to just hucking the crutches down the track.
Yep. The body's planted. Let's all go home.
Well, the car doesn't start.
I love that, though.
That's a great
scene.
It's
so good. I was having actual anxiety.
I was too.
Billy Wilder tried to start his car leaving the studio one day. It didn't start. He came back the next day, said to Raymond Chandler, hey, I got an idea.
We're adding this.
Yeah, that, what I appreciated the most.
Gremlins 2? It's in the movie.
It was like real life where the man had to solve the problem for the woman.
Mm.
Dang, don't do that.
Movie hand, baby. I got to start this
car,
baby. Yeah.
Hey, you think you can manage to not fuck up starting the car?
Yeah.
It was great. No, it was so anxiety inducing, though. Like you said, just God, what the fuck's going to happen? Let's go. Good stuff.
It felt very Coen Brothers-y.
It's interesting. I'm curious on a second watch, like how I'll feel about that scene, because while watching it for the first time, I'm like, holy shit. And then by the end of it, it's like, oh, okay, well, everything's fine. Like,
but it changes the tone of the movie so much
because they stop
like everything from there on out. Yeah. It is just downhill for these characters, and I just love how that's the moment where you're like, maybe they're not going to get away with this.
Oh, I love the glance that he throws her when it won't start. He's like, he throws her like this weird, evil sideways glance, like, you dumb broad.
Those are the exact words that I thought. That's that is what he was going through right there.
So the insurance company is going to rule this a suicide. The man threw himself off the back of a train or accidentally tripped himself up on crutches, and now he's off the back of the train. Keyes, however, finds it statistically improbable that anyone's suicide plan would be to yeet himself off a slow-moving caboose. So Keyes begins suspecting foul play, especially after noticing that Dietrichson never filed a claim for the broken leg.
That's it right there. That's a smoking gun.
Going back about 2 seconds, I want to point out how many times they just hammered home the fact that it's a 15 mile an hour train and like how stupid someone would have to be to die breaking their neck off of that.
For what it's worth. Adjusted for inflation, that's like 90 miles per hour.
Like, last time, I just laughed. I was like, man, I hope this guy feels like an idiot.
Listen, the insurance company is just looking for any reason to deny the claim.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
How fast was Hillary Swank moving towards that stool, the bench? $1 million the baby? Because I 20
miles,
guarantee 20
miles
you,
per hour. It's that gravity.
It was less than 20 miles per hour, terminal speed, and it ended her.
I mean, ended her career.
I haven't seen that.
She falls at the end of the movie onto a stool.
Spoiler
alert. And goes into a coma, and Clint Eastwood has to come in and then put her down.
Ryan.
It might be Morgan Freeman.
What?
I can tell you exactly how fast she was going. It was breakneck speed.
It was right there.
Wow. I'm over here Googling terminal velocity, and Kyle had the answer all along.
Bada bing, you're welcome, boys. Ta-da.
Oh, 180 Thank feet you. per second, I think.
I, you know what? This is going to hit Kyle right in the penis also, because now we're about to talk about his girl, Lola.
Ooh!
Because Phyllis's stepdaughter, Lola, just befriends Walter Neff.
Of course, that's what you do. Just casually, you know, a teenage girl and a 40-year-old man.
Yeah, I mean, it's what you do when you meet a friend and you're going through some shit, and the only person around is the person who made sure that
I
your stepmother is about to get a lot
of
money
to try to fuck him.
The random insurance salesman that came by my house one time. That's who I need to reach out to.
I'll be waiting in your car.
She's also hung up on her shitty boyfriend, Nino, who is the aggressive boyfriend who gets angry all the time.
He don't appreciate you, girl. Dump that zero, get with the hero.
Kyle is pointing to himself. I'm pretty sure she is like super duper dead at this point.
They all are. That's why
everybody
it's safe
in
to
the
say.
Dead.
Is that how it works?
Yeah.
If the movie's old enough, everybody
harassment. If they're a corpse, nope, still is Kyle. Still is.
It's necreural harassment.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Now that Nino's a Kenny character.
All right.
But she also is going to confide in Neff some suspicions that she has about Phyllis killing her mother before she became the stepmother. And she's going to... Well, she did it in order to marry Dietrichson. And she fears that Phyllis's next target she might have already struck. Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun! Lola's like, my stepmom's trying to kill me. Help me, insurance man. As you do.
Why?
As
why
you
is
do.
He the only person that she'll open up to? This is so weird.
Because it's the 40s, babe.
It is, but I also have a theory behind it. We'll get there. Ryan is doing the circle with the finger going through it like it is intercourse. Ryan, we are very much in the Hays Code right now. I can't allow you to do that.
Best I can do is a towel and an anklet.
All right.
I know our listeners can't see that, but my God, man.
Here's my question. With the Hays Code, what is the quota? How?
You're allowed one fuck.
Not the fuck.
in a PG-13, you're
allowed
one
fuck. How many African American people are allowed in the film?
As many as you want, as long as they don't have any kind of intimate relationship
any
with
of
any of the white.
I'm not kidding when I say this. I'm pretty sure within the code, it doesn't mention anything about black slavery, but it does mention something about white slavery.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
You're not allowed
to
show
white
slavery.
The code is a very weird thing. Mm. It's a very weird thing.
It's very, very
dated. For listeners out there that are like me and just had to Google that, the Hays Code was a industry guidelines for self-censorship in content that was applied to most motion pictures between 1934 and 1968.
Yes. And you have, weirdly enough, baseball to thank for it.
That's true.
Because you had the Black Sox scandal, and it kind of created a whole morality around just things. How they're like, oh, that wasn't moral what they did. Whereas other things that are immoral, movies, that's a brand new medium.
Let's
that we need to kind of address that and police
Hollywood's
that.
Corrupt.
And
maybe
the studios
were
actually the ones who policed themselves.
This exact method would later be adopted for the comics code.
It would be.
Exactly.
It's easier to police yourself.
Keys uncovers. You're not allowed to ridicule the clergy with the Hays Code. That's some bullshit.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
You couldn't. And that's kind of the joke behind it, is that you were trying to pass along Christian values to a Jewish-owned industry and a Protestant America.
Huh.
I'm just so happy that no one tries to force religion down anyone's throat today.
I know,
right?
Man.
I mean,
what
I'm so happy this is all in the past.
How is it
I'm not
that,
bummed.
Like, only a few things, like, watching this movie, there are only a couple of, like, noticeable things that are different between... Well, you know, the world back then and the world now. Sure, you have updated building facades and you have technology like cell phones instead of like the other
phone. The dictaphone.
But man, there is not much that has changed in the world. I'm not going around calling everybody baby.
Some things have progressed, thankfully, but we still don't like the insurance companies. They're still the bad guys.
and what the story is based off of is a real life crime story, a true crime novel that came out. And that's why, like, you even see true crime still huge today.
I was gonna say, those
never goes away. People are
now.
Just curious behind it.
Ruth Snyder.
Ruth Snyder, the first woman who was killed by the law.
The
Black
Electric
Chair.
Very, very famous photo of her in the electric chair that the New York, I think it was Daily News person, snuck in a camera on his ankle and took the picture. It's on Wikipedia. You can look at
it's
it.
It's like the
it
most created a famous giant photo of the 1920s. Keys uncovers a
History's
witness.
History's fun, guys. That's why I love the Wayback Machines. I love it.
You learn something along the way.
It is really fun.
Keys uncovers a witness, a Medford man, in fact, who claims the man he saw in the back of the train was not Dietrichson. In super duper subtle grocery store meeting, Neff warns Phyllis to drop the insurance claim to avoid exposure and suggests they avoid each other until the investigation concludes.
I love how they just keep saying, like, no, we're in this right down the line, all the way to the end of the line. I love how this train metaphor just stays the entire time. And it's on all sides.
Wasn't it Phyllis that kind of came up with that line and really started drilling it home every chance she could as soon as the plan really started to get off ground.
Yeah.
So, like, thinking back...
How do you not say off the rails there?
Oh, shit. Well, I mean, it...
Missed opportunity. Been, like, 3 weeks,
guys. Like, looking back, it was... Like, it feels like it's so painfully obvious what it's leading up to, looking yeah. back at all of the breadcrumbs that were left.
We should have got there before we did, but
yeah,
Billy Wilder pulled one over on us.
Yeah.
And it's funny because, like, it is Phyllis the whole time. It was like, all the way to the end of the line, end of the line. But it's not until Keyes says it that Neff is like, oh, shit. All the way to the end of the line. These things usually don't end well.
Yeah.
That's why Keyes even says, like, in the last stop, no getting off. Last stop's the cemetery. It's like, oh, shit.
How did Keyes know about the jail? Train metaphor?
How did he know? He's goddamn good.
Neff is going to learn that Nino, Lola's ex-boyfriend, or current boyfriend, I don't know where they stand. It's not important. He's been visiting Phyllis nightly, and Keyes begins to suspect Nino is Phyllis's accomplice.
That's lucky for Neff, but also, hey, that's my lady there.
Yeah. It
seems like everyone's lady there, Brian.
That's fair.
I liked this scene and that you can almost see this recognition of, oh, that's good for me. But also at the exact same time, you can tell that he knows that. There's no way out of this for him, kind of. Like, she's going to take him down.
Yeah.
Like, that knowledge, it should be more of a relief than it is just due to him knowing that, which I thought was really well put.
His conscience starts to take over a little bit here, too, because he's hanging out with Lola all the time. And now he's like, if she's checking up with Nino, she's got plans for Lola.
It's normal.
For a 40-year-old insurance salesman to hang out with a young... totally but normal.
They lay the breadcrumbs even earlier than that, because when Neff comes back from doing the moita, he is walking back down the street, and he even says, like, and the weirdest thing, I couldn't hear my own footsteps. Like, I had the footsteps of the dead. That was a cool bit. Like, yeah. he is just understanding what he's done here. It's a lot like when you jerk off, and then you suddenly become Bruce Banner again. I feel like that's what happened.
Sounds getting real low, big guy. And we not talk about that for 20 minutes and really psychoanalyze himself. You are what,
you don't imagine yourself with Hulk hands? Banner? Just cranking away? No?
You're cranking as Hulk?
Yeah, Hulkster baby.
You crank to be Hulk?
Angry.
Yeah, no, you crank as Hulk. Angry.
You crank
completely
angry?
Yeah, angry. Yeah.
Really crank angry.
Usually
and
green.
Then because you become Bruce Banner, who's ashamed of what he did as the Hulk.
And your pants are all ripped and you can't explain why.
Are you doing this straight method?
All the times I beat the meats, percentage less than 1% was like fucking angry? Angry?
Why? Are you saying you become the Hulk after you finish? Because that's even weirder.
Yes, because I hate life.
And you come back to life and that's
like the one nice few minutes moment in it. And then I go back to just angry, just a raw nerve.
I love it. I get it.
All right,
that's
so
my secret. I'm always
right.
What?
Never mind. Continue, normal people.
Touching on what Dave just said, that was like from earlier in the movie, right after he got back from the whole train thing, which I liked that. I liked that as it really help keep the tone of the movie. Like, that was still relatively early in the movie, and it's just got this dread, like, foreboding tone around that just really helps propel the second half of the movie.
It changes, and you also have the kind of theme song for this movie, which is very much like a march, like a march to the gallows the entire way through.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good way of putting it.
Neff is going to confront Phyllis. He's going to accuse her of manipulating Nino to kill Lola. Is that correct? Is that what ChatGPT wanted me to do here?
I think that's right.
He accuses her of manipulating pretty much the entire situation.
All of it.
And she's going to shoot Neff, but she hesitates to fire that second shot at him. as Neff is walking towards him, saying, "Do it, baby. Put one in me, just like I put one in you." Ah, I had to get the last scene.
Allegedly.
That would have been a different movie. She confesses her love for him, and I'm not sure if she is still manipulating at this point. I kind of think that's the idea of, does she come back around? Does she not? Is she ever true to herself at any point in this movie? I don't know.
I never loved you until a minute ago when I couldn't pull that trigger a second time.
What do you mean a minute ago? That maybe was like this is why like people choke seconds. Each other. I don't like he got she shot him and she's like, I gave you pain. That felt fucking good in my loins. And like, maybe this is how that got started.
This sounds very sexual, and the Hays Code really should have been enforced a little bit more on this movie.
Well, I love the Hays Code for this movie because they tried to get this script off the ground. Someone else did. It was a book by James M. Cain that came out in 1936, and they tried to put it out. And basically, when they submitted it to the Hays office, they said, no, you can't show that. And then Billy Wilder came back in 1943. He's like, I want to show that. And they're like, yeah, I mean, that was 7 years ago. The world's changed. People don't give a shit about adultery now. Have a ball.
These guys don't need two separate beds. They need two separate rooms.
Yeah.
Though
very flippant time.
Yeah. These guys, both of these characters are terrible, horrible people. They are horrible. Like, and I don't want to even put them on different levels, because I feel like the movie wants you to be, but like they were both there to kill each other because they're terrible people.
I agree.
And they kind of do, because the Neff movie is going to kill her in self-defense.
Yeah.
And he just goes hides in the bushes outside, as you do.
Which is normal.
Totally.
It's normal.
I don't know what normal is.
I feel like they do want you to be Robinson, more sympathetic to
the only
Neff
hero
than Phyllis, which is weird because you're not supposed to be sympathetic to any bad characters according to the Hays Code. There's not supposed to be any kind of celebration of the bad deeds that they're doing. You're not supposed to feel sympathy.
And you're supposed to have the whoever does the bad deeds get their comeuppance.
Exactly. And
they do.
We do.
And we do. But not before, again, Neff hiding in the bushes calls out Nino, and Nino just comes over to the man in the bushes and says, "Hey, Lola's an all right gal.
Hey, what are you doing in these bushes here?"
And he goes, "I'm actually here to slam her stepmother." So,
stepmom.
Yeah, that's a wild relationship that we'll get there again. A lot of we'll
things
get there
that have progressed. The stepmom thing. Who knew? Who knew Billy Wilder?
It's so I love far how ahead Nino, of the time, baby.
I love how Nino comes over and Walter's like, "Yeah, name's Walter." And he goes, "I know, and I still hate it."
It's so good.
It's so good.
So, awesome, I like how they set Walter's back before they even got off the mark. I love it.
Loved it.
Nino, take this quarter. Call your girl. Get out of here. Do yourself a favor. Don't go into that house.
Don't go in that house.
I just moited the girl you're going to bang.
Your girl's going to be real upset soon. Actually, she won't be. She didn't like her mom.
She won't be.
Stepmom.
Because Nino's about to get away with it, too, it seems like.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Neff is going to complete the recorded confession to Keyes. And as you could probably guess, Keyes was just standing behind him long enough to hear a lot of the
reveal.
Confession. It is a good reveal.
So, Keyes, you see, wait a minute. You're standing right behind me, aren't you?
Yeah, here.
How long
this
have
is
you
me
been
speaking into my dictaphone. And oh, God, you're right here.
When did you get here, baby?
How much of that did you hear? Enough.
I love the relationship between Keyes and Neff.
So good.
I love it so much. Because you have this professional relationship, and the punchline to pretty much everything that they say is Neff saying, "I love you too."
So
to
good.
Pretty much everything, as Keyes is like shooting him down, and you can feel that's the love story in this movie is between these two guys. Who single
well,
guys
he wants him to be his...
Why they're not getting married and stuff, but they're married to their work. They're married to each other in this office.
Yeah, he wants him to be his assistant for less money because he likes the guy so much.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He wants to do an insurance scam with him, and he's not picking it up. It's like the lighthouse. Just repressed homosexuality all the way down.
Also against the Hays Code.
Neff is going to try to run off to Mexico. Keyes says, "You're not even going to make the elevator." And guess what? He doesn't. He collapses in the doorway. Keyes is going to call for an ambulance and the police. And Neff and Keyes are just going to wait together. There's this entire running bit about Neff lighting Keys' cigarettes the entire movie, doing that cool flip with the one hand with the match.
And the fucking matches. Everybody likes a match with a thumb.
God, it's so cool.
Absolute.
Love so it. Cool. But in this final scene, as Neff is laying there with the gunshot wound, he's trying to flip the match and it's not working, and Keys is going to be the one to light it. And you get Neff saying, "I love you too," as we fade to black. And that is Double Indemnity from 1944, directed by Billy fucking Wilder. Story and motivation, it's a 10 from me, folks.
Guys, this is probably not be a surprise. It is also a 10 for me.
I mean, 100% I have to agree. It's clear. It's well presented. The narration style benefits it greatly. It's easy to follow. You're enraptured the whole time. When the car doesn't start, you're scared. 10 out of 10.
Mm-hmm. I think it's 10 out of 10.
All right, Ryan.
I need to join a different podcast because... I just, you know, I've got issues with the story, and I'm not even going to get into all of them. I think some things move real quick in terms of character motivation. Mm-hmm. I agree with a lot of what was said. I love, 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 love the relationship between Robinson and McMurray. So good. I don't know. I'm not going to get super into it,
but I
do feel like...
This is the time to get into it, my friend.
It is long. For what it is, and for as complicated of a plot as it might seem, it's really not that complicated. So there are parts where it is kind of just a little long in the tooth in the story, and I don't feel like it's quite as tight as some of the other movies I've seen around this time. I don't know. I like it. I like it quite a bit, but I don't like this as much as like The Apartment or Sunset
That's
Boulevard,
not this time.
Two other
they're
Wilder
very,
movies.
They're drastically different. You're talking about three
they're
different
They're drastically
decades at that
different
point.
And they're much older. Yeah, exactly.
No, they're not. The Apartment's 1960 and Sunset Boulevard is 1952.
Older. Sorry. They came out later, is what I meant. But okay. Sorry. Let me rephrase. Billy Wilder is much older by that point, mm-hmm. and I feel like he has. So much more, I don't know, command as a director. And this does not, now seeing this, which is his first film of those three, it is hard going back to something that is much more simplistic than those other two movies. And I have grown to love those other two movies. And this just feels like it's fine. A lot of the story is fine. I don't feel like there's a lot of twists to anything. It feels pretty straight down the line. Ah. But that's for the time. And
save that for screenplay.
And I don't know. Story-wise, there's a lot to love here. I think it's in the style. I think it's in the acting. I think it's mm-hmm. in the character. Mm-hmm. It's not in the story. I think the story is like a 6 out of 10. Ooh. I don't love the story here. I think it's fine.
And in defense of mine, I'd like the part that this sort of flips the noir formula in the fact that we're getting the criminal side aspect and put it's a cool flip dichotomy of this thing that this genre that's created. And I like that one of the earliest versions is already playing with it. So it's cool to me in that aspect.
With tens across the board and a 6, that's actually going to average out to a 9.
Hey,
look at you go. What a shot fired. I love it.
Next category is protagonist.
Is there one? It's a real stuff.
That is a good question.
Like the person who pushes the story along is Walter Neff, Fred McMurray.
Yeah.
That's, yeah.
And according to the Hays Code, we're not allowed to identify with him.
You're not allowed to. Yeah. But at the same time, let me ask you this question. It's a theory I have about this movie now. I've seen it a million times. Is Walter Neff a reliable narrator?
I think he's probably buttering his parts up. I agree with you there. He's trying to make it look not so bad. He knows he fucked up, but
I would say if he wasn't going to tell the truth, why leave a confession at all?
Because he knows he's had.
I think
why not make a break for Mexico?
More than anything, and then he kind of went too far. With a lot of stuff.
But I definitely
agree.
I also
think
that's. He might not be.
I think that's where a lot of like the lingo has issues too, is that he kind of like in the flashback stuff as he's talking to the dictaphone makes himself almost sound cooler than we ever see him when he's in the office alone with Keys.
That's
which
true.
Which is kind of what we have to know to believe to be the truth.
Because in all of his storytelling, he lights the match and is super cool. But when Keys is there, he doesn't light the match. So it's
interesting. Yeah.
That's interesting.
He's an unreliable narrator. Who embellishes?
Maybe. He may be.
It also would explain why the movie seems to frame him more sympathetically than it does Phyllis.
Oh, yeah.
That's interesting.
I still don't like him as a protagonist.
Or it could just be the sexism of the 40s. Come on.
Well, it's definitely going to be part of
Come on.
Oh, somebody's bad here? It's obviously the dame.
It's the... Come on.
The brand of sexism you're talking about would make it so Phyllis is not even capable of committing this murder without him. So...
But they do present her as kind of like a cold, manipulative, one-note character. So
they don't present her as kind of. She is the cold, manipulative character. She doesn't do anything.
And then Jean Heather, who got an extra point earlier, is literally just an object. She does nothing in this movie. She does not really help.
Oh, yeah, like I said,
along. She just complicates things.
I like this movie from the 40s. Yeah,
sexist 40s.
I was also being a bit silly with my overt praise of her.
Protagonist. Throw out some numbers. Let's hear what you got.
I'll go
1.5.
Not allowed.
Fractions?
Son of a bitch. I was going to say, I'm going to copy scale? Ryan from the last round. I'll go 6.
6.
I like everybody in it, but you're not supposed to like them, and they're not good people. There's not really a protagonist. I do love the one good guy, but we're not seeing it from his angle. 6.
Well.
Yeah.
Like, it is an entire... Sorry, go ahead.
Barton Keyes is like the only good character in this movie-ish. And he's also a flawed man, but, I mean, doesn't make him any less good, I guess. But he's like the only one that isn't an evil piece of shit. Like, he's gonna give... He, as an insurance person, is going to give you that money if he doesn't think that you did something wrong. And he only goes
off
his gut.
That does say something.
Yeah.
Got that little man in his chest.
Never been wrong.
Oh, yeah, the little man in the chest.
The little man. I love the little man that he keeps talking about. I love it.
Maybe Keyes is the protagonist here.
Also, regardless if Keyes is the protagonist or not, 3.
Ooh.
All right.
Brian, that's twice you've kind of had that reaction. Where are you thinking?
I don't know, because I still don't know who the protagonist is, and that puts me in a weird spot. I think, like, I want to kind of play it safe and give it a 5, but I like it, damn it, so a 6? I think I'm right with Kyle with a 6.
That's kind of where my head is at in those exact words.
I understand the system.
What you got, Ryan?
I guess I'll interpret it as Fred McMurray is the protagonist. And I'm rating not as how good or honorable the protagonist is, because that's whatever. You can have any kind of protagonist. The Joker can be a protagonist. Right. It's about how interesting they are and how interesting of a character they are, what you're doing with that character. And that's why I'm going to go lower, because I don't think he's the interesting character here. I have some frustrations with him. I'm kind of right down the middle, so I'm going to stick right at the 5 and not give the 6+. I've got issues with the protagonist. I wish he was more dastardly or more charming or more just something. There's just...
Honestly, less everyman?
Kind of, because if we're going to go every man, then we do get into like something like A Simple Plan, where you get like these just every man into like a situation over their heads. And I never get that from him here. He always feels like he knows what's up. Yeah. So like kind of the every man is out the window with his confidence and ego.
He's an expert in his field.
I don't get every man from him either. So I don't know what to get from him.
I get you, and this movie does a lot of neat little tricks where, I mean, even the way that the movie opens up with him driving to the office in LA, it opens with him driving through a stop sign, showing that he's kind of in this rush. This entire movie is that. It's him going through every possible stop sign.
Doesn't even.
He is wow. just. Yeah. Yeah.
There's no nuance to that, though. And that's maybe my frustration.
But does there need to be? Because this entire movie takes place within this entire movie. We don't have any motivation for why he does what he does.
There,
that has never come up, and that's crazy to me.
I think that's an issue. And that's part of, like, the, like, let's fully commit to this insurance fraud scam. There's no turn. He is just a straight and narrow dude doing what is, like, right by the insurance company, having a good relationship with Keys, and then all of a sudden, like, real quick, this dame to kill for walks in, and he's like, yes, insurance fraud.
But then why does it work even without that backstory?
I don't know that it does work. I have issues with it. That's what I'm saying. I have extreme issues with this movie.
High school's chemistry teachers just don't break bad like that, yo.
Yeah.
That is also very different. That is a death, like, it is a life defining circumstance, right? If we're gonna bring up that comparison, Walter White is faced with mortality ending cancer.
Sure.
Versus maybe Walter somebody who is just bored and wants to commit insurance fraud and has been thinking on this idly. Different circumstances.
So let me bring this part up then also, because a lot of what film criticism says about this movie is that it seems like it's when you work in a job, let's say, and you know a lot about what you do and you kind of learn the ins and outs of it, you start to think that you can start getting away with things and knowing how to manipulate the system that you're working within. And Walter Neff doesn't hide that that is who he is in this movie. He's the guy who's always a step ahead. He's always the guy who is trying to now get one over on the guy he doesn't. The challenge, if you will, that Keys is the only real challenge. He thinks that he is above that guy who has so much more experience than him now.
Okay. All right. I think that's a good read on the character. Okay.
Yeah. There's actually a story that the writer of the original novella, whose name is escaping me in this moment,
James Cain,
tells about why he wrote it. And he was talking to a typesetter who ran a headline, and I don't even remember what the headline was, but he snuck in an F-bomb in this headline that went out in the news. And they asked him, like, why'd you do it? He's like, well, you spend all this time going through and looking for these errors so you can correct them. And then a little part of you at one point goes, now you're looking for the opportunity to do it instead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, that is a character who has just grown so bored and complacent with their life that they're looking for adventure anywhere versus Walter White.
And also horny.
Who is
super horny.
And Thelma and Louise.
Who is horny? Oh, yeah.
Shutting it down there. So because Walter White was far enough stretch for this one.
That was all.
Far enough stretch. I'm shutting it down there. What do we think of protagonists?
I believe that average is out to a 5.
Beautiful. Let's talk about the antagonist.
Phyllis.
Oh, I'll be quick. 10. I think she's great.
She's very manipulative.
Mm-hmm. Fun to watch.
I'm going 10 strictly based on the history here. Yeah. She invented this version of the femme fatale that is still carrying 80 years later.
Yeah. I am going to agree with both of you, but I'm going to deduct a point for the blonde wig. It's a 9.
I can't deduct the blonde wig. It's on purpose. It's completely on purpose.
No. Billy Wilder has since come out and said that he told people it was on purpose as a way.
When? Post-mortem?
Not post-mortem. In interviews before he died, my friend.
They've summoned his spirit.
I will go back right now and go get my conversation with Wilder by Cameron Crowe that is literally 10 feet behind me where he is openly talking about the blonde wig and why they did it on purpose.
I can go necro.
I also have interviews with him stating about why he made up the lie about the blonde wig.
Give me it. This is exciting.
Well, now I can't find it.
I should say, in that book, he also bashes Tarantino, and it's fantastic.
Oh, I love that. Amazing. Let's get into
Cameron
Crowe
asked him if he saw Pulp Fiction. He's like, yeah, Pulp Fiction was great. What has he done since then? And Cameron Crowe's like, oh, he hasn't made another one yet. He's like, yeah, he hasn't taken another chance. Yeah, I get it. Like, I love Billy Wilder so fucking much. This was in the late 90s at this point.
Yeah.
This is kind of more around the time when Jerry Maguire came out, because he tried to get Billy Wilder to be in Jerry Maguire as kind of the mentor character for Jerry, who has those kind of asides.
I feel like Jackie Brown's a bit of a chance, but in a different way.
I don't think it was the interview was done. I think the interview was done before Jackie Brown came out.
I can't remember where in the 90s Jackie Brown came out, I believe, but that's the
Jackie
only
Brown
one I was.
I was going to say 97. I believe it's 97.
Like, it was a few years later.
I'd hang my hat on it. I'm looking at
it. I see.
So, Billy Wilder, famously, when people say, the wig, it looks so phony, he says, oh, you noticed that? That was my intention. I wanted the phoniness in the girl, bad taste, phony wig. That's how I get out of it. Basically, they started shooting it, and he was like, keep the wig. We want him to be blonde. Blondes have more fun, etc. And then, a few weeks into production, he was like, 4 weeks in, he actually have a quote here, said, but after the picture is half finished, after I shot for 4 weeks with Stanwyck, now I know I made a mistake. I can't say, look, tomorrow you ain't going to be wearing the blonde wig. I'm stuck. I can't reshoot 4 weeks of stuff. I'm totally stuck. I've committed myself. The mistake was caught too late. Fortunately, it didn't hurt the picture, but it was too thick. We're not very clever about wig making.
Love it. And I learned something. I love that. That is awesome.
But yeah,
you can hold that inside for 60 years.
He's like, oh, yeah, it's supposed to look phony. And that's how he gets out of it.
Mm-hmm. Wilder was the original Andy Kaufman.
That's
sure. Wow.
A very strange played comparison to make.
As a fan of
it wasn't great.
The Samurai Cop wig. I can't hate on this wig. I love it. I think it's great. So
the Samurai Cop wig
it's
is
so
the
iconic.
Top 10 wig in cinema history.
Mm-hmm.
Top 10. I didn't know it was a wig.
It's not always a wig. That's what's beautiful.
It's not. That's the problem.
Oh.
It's just when it's very obviously is the wig, it's hilarious. Like when it falls so off good. In the middle of the fight.
Yeah. God,
what? Dude, we'll have to watch Samurai Cop again together sometime.
Yes, please.
Again.
Yes, please.
Yeah.
I won't get upset about talking about Samurai Cop again.
I will 100% watch Samurai Cop.
Antagonist.
Again. 10.
Are we 10s across the board?
Well, let's see what Ryan says. 10?
10s across the board.
No. No, motherfuckers, this is the, I will 10 on this one. I will 10 so hard.
Why are you making this
her.
Sound like a hot take?
All right.
It's well, a hot take.
A 10 is hot
me,
a hot
who
take.
Has been so lukewarm.
I'm the only one
now
who
I'm
didn't
hot.
Give her a 10.
Now I'm hot on it.
Now I'm the one with the hot take because I gave her a 9 because of her wig. That averages out to a 10. Next category is director.
Oh.
I'll start 11. Okay, you guys talk about yourselves.
That's what I thought.
You have
director?
One rule.
Is it director at the time or director now that we know everything they've done?
Director,
it's the director
from
of this movie, the what he made in this
or
movie.
Just what they're doing here.
Yeah.
Don't bring anything
about
else they've done
this
in.
Movie.
Only the direction here. Okay. All right.
Why don't you
go? I'll go 8.
8.
Yeah.
Do you care to elaborate?
I'll go 10. I think visually and direction wise.
No.
Cool.
Yeah.
Sean's a 10.
10.
Good. All right.
Dang. All right. Shit.
I like Sean's reasoning. Visually and director wise. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I realized other people were talking, so I just like faded out.
I think you nailed it, though. That was my favorite part.
100% correct, though.
Succinct. I think because, you know, direction. Yeah.
I think I'm with Kyle, but I'm more wordy. I think it's an 8. I know. I really like it. I think it's great. I think a lot of the direction is great. It is. And I can't help but bring in the other Wilder, and I've seen what he's done, and there are touches here I really like, but then I also feel like I have seen A+ cinematography from a Billy Wilder movie, and there's great shots here, but nothing that lines up to like 10 shots I can pull out real quick from the apartment. And I think that's like the thing holding me back, and that's my fault and my bias that I'm bringing to it. But
let me ask you this thing.
I think
the
this
next
is a
thing
great
we're going to talk about
black
is
and white movie, but not
the next
the
thing
best
we're
black and white movie I've seen.
The next thing we're going to talk about is style and tone, which is going to be mostly on the cinematography tied. So if
So maybe I should put that there.
Yeah, maybe try to focus on the direction, acting, the way things are framed, the way the story is told.
Oh,
maybe.
Okay.
Like maybe then, that because you didn't know Silent Hill.
Okay, sorry. So we'll just that's my score for the next one is an 8, and what I said that just goes forward. For direction, then, if we're going with that, then I might go slightly lower, and I'll go a 7. I have seen Wilder do better. I think the pacing is a little off here. It's not as tight as some of his other movies. And again, I have some issues with McMurray's acting. Not necessarily fault, but, like, goddamn, he gets some great banter out of, like, the two of them. Like, McMurray and Robinson bounce off. So, like, whatever issues I have, like, ultimately, I'm still very positive on it. I just want to love it a little bit more. So, like, I'm 7. I feel like that's right in the middle between, like it and love it.
That's fair. And that gives an average of a 9 for that category. We move to style and tone.
Ryan, you might as well kick it off here, bud.
8. I think it's really great, but I've seen better black and white movies. I think there's a lot of things to like, but I've seen a little bit better. That's it.
On the flip side of that, I got to go with 10 because I've seen next to no black and white films, and I thought this was fantastic. So I have nothing to drag my score down.
I gave
how
the director an
nice
8.
It is to be you.
But I think I'm also gonna go a 10 because as far as noir films go, man, this is pretty top tier. I agree with Dave fully on that, and I think it nails every part of that aesthetic. I love every bit of it. It's so over the top, sometimes it's silly, but I enjoy that part of it. So I love this one. It's a lot of fun.
I agree with that, and I'm going to actually take it a little bit further. I think I'm going to go at 11 on this category.
I'm joining Brian on 11
this,
on this category.
This is
and I'll explain why gladly. Gladly, I'll explain.
I think it's going to be easier to explain when we get to impact on the industry, but let's just say
there's
the man invented a genre here.
The man invented a genre that wasn't going to be named for another 20 years. Like, they didn't know that this was a thing. They just made a movie.
It is.
It happened to fit into this. But
dripping.
In terms of the style and tone,
style.
You also have shots that were invented for this movie that are still around today. The cinematographer, John Seitz, came up with one of the most iconic shots that you see in film.
Which is?
Using Venetian blinds.
Oh,
really?
Really?
I thought it was going to be
for this movie
with a very obvious projector screen behind it for driving.
Nope, that's just bad rear projection. Totally
Welcome
different.
To the Ford,
no, John Seitz came up with putting the light behind the Venetian blinds and using that to show kind of an imprisonment of a character, and it still
that's
gets
really
used
cool.
constantly today,
all the time.
And then on top of that, they asked him how can we make L.A. look dusty. How can we make it look like it's lived in?
Mm-hmm.
And they actually put aluminum dust particles in the air to bounce off
totally healthy
the light that's in there in order to create that dusty look because dust won't show up on screen. And now today they would just use smoke because it's easier. But they did the aluminum dust particles for that and it was kind of groundbreaking.
Yeah.
I like my film noir with a touch of cancer.
Gotta have it. Gotta have it. You think the smoking's the bad part in this movie? Oh, you fool.
That is going to give an average of a 10 for style and tone. The next category is screenplay.
Written by Billy Wilder and Raymond fucking Chandler.
These two famously butted heads on this.
Famously.
I would love to hear more and why.
Raymond Chandler was one of the elite detective writers of this time, kind of up there with like Dashiell Hammett and James Caine. Raymond Chandler didn't give a shit about either of those two.
No, in fact, he kind of hated Caine.
Yeah, he kind of hated Caine. And the reason why Billy Wilder wanted Raymond Chandler to come in was because Raymond Chandler was really, really good at writing dialogue.
Okay.
So he was a Kevin Smith.
No, because he wasn't up his own ass as much, and Kevin Smith might appreciate me saying that. What they
Kevin
did, they
Smith's
went
like
into the writer's
name.
Yeah, well, Raymond Chandler never wrote a film script. This was his introduction to Hollywood, And he said, listen, I'll get you a script by Monday. You got to pay me $75 a week. To which they said, yeah, we're going to pay you like $150 a week. And you have like 6 weeks to write this thing. What the? Billy Wilder
yeah.
had to basically teach him how to write a screenplay because he came back like 3 days later with the screenplay. Billy Wilder just dumped it in the trash. They're off to a great start.
Whoa.
Eventually, Raymond Chandler is going to quit this movie multiple times because he doesn't want to be told to open a window every now and then. And he got really tired of Billy Wilder pointing his cane at him and telling him to do stuff. And then Billy Wilder eventually would rub this in his face by just asking permission for every little thing for the entire production. Raymond Chandler famously was in Alcoholics Anonymous before going into this. He very much fell off the wagon because of Billy Wilder.
Wow.
Wow.
They didn't get along.
Dang. What has Raymond Chandler done outside of this? What are some of his other works? What's that?
Sam Spade books.
Sam Spade.
So what's Big that? Sleep.
Detective.
Long Kiss Goodbye. Those types of detective.
Oh, books. A series. Okay.
He was like the go-to of this time. I have you're my saying? Number for screenplay. That I want to hold back a little bit because I kind of want to hear what you guys have to say.
Again, like I really enjoyed it. I think it Ryan says it gets a little long in the tooth, and which is generally my argument with every movie. But even clocking in at 2 hours, I didn't mind it in this flick. I didn't ever feel bored in this movie. I enjoyed everything that was happening. I'm going to give it a solid 9.
I will also be giving it a 9, but because that's honestly me docking it, because I do think that it ran a little long in the tooth. Mm-hmm. And tooth, don't get me wrong. Like there wasn't a time while watching this where I'm like, ugh, I would rather be doing anything else. It just like, it was noticeable to me at points that I'm like, wow, this is getting a little long here or a little long there. So docking it at a point, cause I think it could have been tightened up 9.
I did like her a lot, but we totally didn't need the scene where they went and had the talk in the fucking forest grove.
The Hollywood Bowl?
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah, totally didn't need any of that.
I like that even James Cain said that Wilder and Chandler used storytelling techniques that he wished he had used in the original story.
The dictaphone.
Dictaphone. Mm-hmm. He's like, ah, it's such a good literary use, you know, the famous phrase literary use. I am going to give this a 10.
Okay. The dictaphone would come back to be a big part of the, you know, the famous Flintstones movie too, with the dick bird being a central plot.
That's right. Save it for impact on the industry.
When I was watching this, Flintstones, specifically Viva Rock. I can't even do it. Rock Vegas, whatever. Stupid shit. I think I'm a 10. I'm not gonna bury the lead. I already took off points for like the slog in the director part. If we're just talking screenplay, I count that as like almost the script and the dialogue, and the dialogue's perfect. I love the dialogue. The banter is so good throughout. If I have any issues with the length, it's not because of the dialogue. In fact, whatever. The dialogue's perfect. No issues here. 10. 10.
Since it's going to score a 10 anyway, I'm going to give it an 11. And it is almost entirely based on the dictaphone, because the dictaphone that they used made it so that you can have the monologue of the main character going throughout the entire movie. Mm-hmm. Something that's going to be used in this genre from here on out.
Forever. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever, guys ever seen the video of the dude crushing the dictaphone when he's live on TV? It's great. He's got like this rare wax dictaphone from like the 1800s, and he's showing it off on TV, and he holds it and he like cracks it and it shatters and he goes, oh shit. It's one of my favorite. I'll send it to you guys. Again. I'll write it down.
What have I done?
This is a moment where I wish that we did video, because I wish we had a dictaphone meter, like a counter. Like on the corner of the screen where it's just ticking up every time.
Every time you say dictaphone.
I have never heard that word before in my life tonight.
Say
so many.
Thank you for saying that, Sean, because 100% I was going to say, I've never seen a dictaphone before this movie, let alone a YouTube video of somebody breaking a dictaphone.
Right? I thought you guys were joking with the name and like making fun of it, but that's wild. That's very cool.
Not everything is dick joke, Sean. Not everything. Yeah. Most things,
I understand
yes.
with
yes,
me, but... you would think that it would be, though.
I like yes. telephone-based jokes.
They're better than dick jokes.
There's literally something called a xylophone.
Phone jokes. Like...
You don't know.
Are you just anyway. Discovering this? Yes. Yeah, because that's the way you just worded that. Like, can you guys fucking believe there's a thing called a xylophone?
Guys, you're not going to believe what letter it starts with.
Shit.
Different colors.
Oh, it starts with an X. Are you kidding me? Oh, my God.
Not only do I know a xylophone, I'm trained in how to play a xylophone.
No
it's
way.
Part of the percussion. Yeah, I had to play it from sixth grade all through high school. I know it's how like to read fucking sheet music. I'm in, baby.
Shit's like a controlled wind chime.
Hey, mm-hmm. Speaking of xylophones and reading music, the next category is music.
Ooh, baby. It's like so Lethal good. Weapon took its wiener out and peed all over this. No, this movie has that, all that great, like, tense horns and stunning, like, it builds atmosphere great. I'm also going to give it a 9.
I'll dive in here and I'll go 9 as well. I really like the march, kind of the gallows mm-hmm. feel.
The march is
it's
really
very
cool.
Very repetitive, though, but I really don't give a shit. I've seen it a 1,000 times. Every bit of it's still stuck in my head. Mm. So I love it.
Paramount's music director, Louis Lipstone, hated the music. And he said, this is Carnegie Hall music. You need to learn how to write music for film. Speaking, of course, to Miklos Roza's Damn. Score. And he was trying to get somebody to back him up. He's like, right, Billy? Right? And Billy Wilder was like, I'll have you know that I fucking love the music. Nice. And so he tried to go over his head and go to the Paramount artistic director, Buddy De Silva. And De Silva also said, oh, I love this dissonant, hard-hitting score. There should be more of it. So, you know, fuck Louis Lipstone is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And the score was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Music.
Are you saying Lipstone?
Yes, Lipstone.
It sounds like that guy would know something about music. Being named Lipstone.
He was the music director for Paramount Studios.
But I'm going to give this a solid 9. Tonally. Does an integral part of setting the tone that this movie is presenting and really bringing that to life. And I just talked myself into a 10.
Nice.
I'm going 10. If the music in a movie is so important, like so integral in really helping convey your tone of your movie, it's doing its job and it's doing it really well. And I think it did a fantastic job in what it needed to do.
I like the way you just worded that, because one of the ways I always look at music in movies is A, is it memorable? B, is it appropriate?
Yeah.
And this is very appropriate. And just Super. To me, it's memorable just because I've seen it 1,000 times. So it's. Mm-hmm. It's ingrained for yeah. forever. I'm constantly marching to the gallows.
Before Constant. Sean changed the score to a 10, I was going to say, I'm going to jump on this 9 train, but I'm not changing it because Sean did. I'm still going with a 9.
Nice. I think the A, is it memorable? A or B, is it appropriate? I think you're right. It's super appropriate. Outside of the marching death gallow theme, I don't really remember a lot of this music 2 weeks out. So with that, I'm going to go with 8, but it doesn't matter because it's going to be a 9
oh,
or
darn.
10, whatever.
That averages so, out whatever. Sean's 10 I'm gonna go 8. For a straight 9.
It's solid as hell for not remembering. Yeah.
But you're right. Like the it had a theme and it was super appropriate. It fit the, and so like a 10 is something like I'm still fucking humming like yeah. every week from that. It's not quite there, but it's still
10
really
to me
good.
Is Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 1 awesome. Like that's a 10. So that's probably
100%. And yeah, I would fucking argue the score too. I love the
yeah,
Guardians
fucking love
theme.
It.
Good stuff.
Love it.
Mm-hmm.
The next category actually isn't up for debate. It is the box office. And we have pre-set scale here based on the percentage it made versus its original budget. This movie cost $927,000 to make, which adjusted for inflation is about $16.8 million. And its worldwide gross at the time was $5.7 million, which is a lot of money in 44. About $101 million today.
It's like 5 years of car.
That's a big ol' hit.
That is like a 600% return. So that's a 10.
It's the mid-level, mid-budget movie that doesn't exist anymore.
Yep.
The art house, the higher budget art house flick that everybody loves.
That's this was the Paranormal Activity. 1944.
That's its own monster.
More like an A24 thing, I think.
Yeah, that's what I was going with. That the mean creeps A24. That we don't get A24. Anymore.
Yeah. The final category, and this is going to be a doozy, it's the impact on the industry.
11. Talk amongst yourselves.
Yep, 11. I agree.
I was going to say, I hate that Dave cut me off because I wouldn't be the first to say 11. It was the only category I would give an 11 to, but absolutely, you have to.
Yeah, same. No surprise here. Also same. 11.
Sean?
I'm riding the boat with you guys.
Woo!
I'm riding the train.
Transportation here.
Come on, ride the train. Choo-choo, ride it. Don't fall off and break your neck and fall for an insurance scam.
It's a good tune. You know, I've heard that vehicular manslaughter is easier to get away with than regular manslaughter.
Woo!
The final score for Double Indemnity is going to be a 92.
So we're actually below what the critics and the audience think.
Yeah.
Because
the critics gave this thing a 97%, which I actually thought was a little surprising because I thought this was going to be one of those rare hundos that they have just because the critics love this type of shit.
Yeah. They love dictaphones.
There's one fucking person out there.
There's always one who said, Walter Neff, I don't get it. Ryan, stop writing reviews. Thank you.
All right, done. Sorry.
He's like Aaron from The Office. I don't get it.
You for just indulging me on this one. I love the Wayback Machine so much. I love when seeing where things come from. And yeah. I know a lot of your favorite movies, things like a Blade Runner or like a Drive, come directly from this movie because neo-noir is not too far along coming into like the 70s and whatnot. And you get to kind of see where it all comes from. And I love that. So thank you for indulging me on this one.
I'm always surprised when we go back to the old movies, how much they hold up. And I go, oh man, why have I been sleeping on this old stuff for so long?
80 years old, still works.
Wild.
I almost love and hate going to a movie like this or going to a time period I don't get to see very often or watch a genre that I also don't get to see very often. I love and hate it because I almost always very much so enjoy it. But then on the other side of that, I know that I'm just going to go down this never-ending rabbit hole for the next 2 months.
Yep.
Where lucky I'm guy. Just going, I'm going to just dive and straight down the line.
Now I gotta watch a bunch of Billy Wilder movies, I guess.
Sounds like you're
please watch The Apartment if you have not. The Apartment.
We did
so
an episode
gorgeous.
Of The Apartment. But
so beautiful. I know. Time. I'm saying Sean. Oh. Sean, watch The Apartment. Sean, specifically.
Assignment misunderstood. So I just watched a bunch of Gene Wilder flicks.
Hey, also not a bad time.
In about 2 months, I won't be able to come on here and be like, I don't feel like I'm qualified to give a number here.
Oh, fair enough, yeah.
Brian, I
look
believe
forward to being
it's up
that
to
person
you
then.
Next week, right?
Yeah, next week is my pick. And I'm gonna go way forward in the machine and go all the way from 1944 to 2024. Because there's a movie that came out last year that I've been dying to see. And like, if I'm not using this for that purpose, to see the movies I want to, what are we doing here?
Yeah. Fuck yeah.
You know? So I saw the TV Glow came out last year, and I've heard mixed reviews, but mostly good reviews. I've heard that I don't want to know too much going in, so I don't.
No.
And that's what we're going to be talking about next week, is I saw the TV Glow.
Tight. Exciting.
Hell yeah.
It's a horror movie that's not a horror movie. That's about all I know.
Spoilers.
100%.
Yeah, I can't wait to talk about that movie, honestly.
So, very excited.
I think so Ryan, Sean, and I, it sounds like, have all seen it. Dave, have you seen it?
Nope, only heard about it last week when Brian told me about it.
All right, cool. This will be exciting. I'm stoked for you two guys to see it.
But just in case you guys want to hear our voice a little bit more in the week, you don't want to wait until next week, check us out on Friday, where you can see our bonus episode that we record every week before we record this episode. You know, that's where you'll see our little, like, references. And if you want to be cool and figure out what they mean, go sign up for our Patreon. Patreon.com/experiencegrind. You can also be a part of our Discord, which is a great place for a whole bunch of awesome people to get together, chat about movies, TV, games.
Sean loves that
playing Rivals
channel.
Come play Rivals with us. But there's going to be a link to that in the episode link.
This is fun, guys.
This is a lot of fun.
Thank you for sharing this with us. I love going in the Wayback Machine. It's fun.
Maybe we'll
I'm
do
very
it more.
Surprised that this episode we'll is as long as that movie was. Almost like to the minute.
Yep. I did.
It was very long in the tooth. Yes.
Challenge myself to Ryan earlier to try to make all of my choices this year 1980s flicks, but I've already broken that. But we haven't done my official selection yet, so.
What is your selection?
So you could still stick to it.
I don't want to give that away yet. You guys know, but we're riding Brian's movie for next week right now.
There you go. That's folks, true. Stay tuned. See if Kyle sticks to his word for more than a week. We'll see. And until then, go love yourselves.